Welcome to the Sober Awakening Podcast, where we empower individuals to cultivate a sober mindset and deepen their intuitive connection to the divine spark within. I'm Tim Lyons, the president, CEO, and founder of Sober Awakening, a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to providing inspiration, resources, and community support for sober-minded individuals seeking spiritual growth and purpose. Please note that Sober Awakening does not have a financial relationship with any businesses, products, or services mentioned in this podcast. Any mentions are shared solely because they align with our mission to support your journey towards sobriety, self-discovery, and spiritual fulfillment. Now let's dive in and journey toward a life of clarity, connection, and empowerment together.
What's up, everybody? I am Tim Lyons. I am the president, CEO, and founder of Sober Awakening. And you are here for the very first edition of the Sober Awakening podcast with our very special guest, our Sober Awakening board member also, London Reber. And London is sober. She has been sober now for 13 years. She is a wife, mother, stepmom. She is homeschooling her beautiful children. She is also the 2012 Miss California, United States. She is the 2023 Women's World Magazine Supermom Contest winner. She is a certified relationship and parenting coach. And she is also a phase one and phase two graduate of the Earth Magic Academy Intuitive Into You program, I think we call that, because I am a graduate of this program as well, which is how we know each other. But so, London, thank you for being here for our very first Sober Awakening podcast episode. I am so delighted to have you so involved, and you have just brought so much to my life knowing you and getting to know about your journey into sobriety and being with you on this journey to deeper our intuition and our intuitive abilities. And you're just an amazing person. So I thought, starting this up, who better to rock and roll with than my good friend, London Reber? How was that?
Wow. Thank you, Tim. Thank you so much.
All right.
Absolutely honored to be here. I am inspired by what you're doing. Congratulations for starting this nonprofit and now launching it into a podcast. It's going to help so many people who are at that crossroads between their spiritual awakening and their sobriety, whichever direction it comes from. You know, if you're already sober and you're working on your spiritual awakening, or if you've had a spiritual awakening and now you're considering being sober, we are here at that cross point in the middle to really touch and support as many people as we can through this nonprofit. And I just am I'm so blessed and honored that you have asked me to be on the board, and now that I get to be your first guest on the show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I know that we could both sit here and talk about our experiences in a whole variety of ways. I don't want these episodes to be really about me. I want them to be about the guests. So what I'd like to start with, first of all, is you were quite the party girl back in the day, from what you have told what I understand. Well, if you've been sober for 13 years, there is a reason you made the choice to enter the world of sobriety. You know, me, like I told you, I got to a point where I was just, I think I was 39 years old, and I was literally, my bottom, I was quote unquote gutter drunk, where I had to go to the hospital. I would physically get sick if I didn't have alcohol in my system. We all have different bottoms though. So with you, what was your drinking history? Let's just start there with where you were at in your addiction, your abuse of alcohol and or other drugs. What caused you to take the leap into sobriety? Right. So just kind of pretend you're in that first AA meeting. What was kind of your story, and, you know, fill us in.
So I started off drinking like most people, I think, do. Well, really, everybody has a different story. So I would like to preface it that, like, I like to look for the similarities in feelings that I had when other people share their sobriety stories. Like, if you felt similar to how I felt, because the circumstance looks different for everybody. And I think that's why it's so important that people see different versions of what sobriety looks like, because until I got sober, I really didn't even consider it like an option for my life. Like, I didn't even know that was a thing that I could do or would do. Now, when I meet people, they're like, "You're sober," you know, it like often will surprise people. And so I like because your story is so different than mine, to just really encourage people to listen to the similarities and let the differences, you know, just kind of like take what works for you and leave the rest kind of attitude. So I started out drinking like around freshman year of high school. And the very first time we ever got like drunk was like pretty soon. I don't remember my first drink, honestly. I just remember my first drunk. And it was like a debacle in my backyard. And I hid the bottles of the alcohol in my pajama drawer because I had this like bright idea that we were going to write down all the memories that happened that night. We were going to put them in the bottles, and then I was going to save them for like the rest of my life. I'm like 14 years old. It's like, where are you going to save these? And it was just over one night, you know? And so my mom found them in my drawer, putting away some laundry, and like laid them out on the floor. And I came home from basketball practice one day. She was like totally upset with me, and I couldn't figure out why. And then I walked in. They're all over my bedroom floor, and I'm giving her that story. Well, I'm going to put the memories in them and da-da-da. And she actually said, "I think you're an alcoholic," like right away, right then. And I had like barely just started my drinking career. And so it's really wild that, you know, the foreshadowing of that. And I say that because I went on to drink until I was 27. And I truly believe that it has to be where somebody concedes to their innermost self that they have a problem with alcohol, or otherwise it will never really last. I'm curious if that was your experience, like if you had tried to stop before for like maybe a job or maybe a loved one, you know, like your wife or something. And then like, if that made a difference once you truly hit a bottom where you realized that this was your truth, and then you were able to do something different to get a different result.
Yes, absolutely. I was the type of person who I did try to stop several times. You know, I went through the whole progression of making deals with myself, and then I would, because I knew I had a problem. Right. I knew I had a problem. I had admitted that to myself. But, you know, I was never as bad as so-and-so or so-and-so or so-and-so. And I was the type to where I could get my willpower up to a point until it got really bad and I was physically dependent. I could shut it off for a week or so, and I'd dry out, and then it's, see, look, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. I remember the first time I did that, I was raised Catholic, and it's typical to give up something for Lent when you're Catholic. And what I did was, when I was in school, I was in my second year of grad school. I was 23 years old, and I gave up beer. I gave up drinking for Lent. And that was about 6 weeks, right? So I was like, "Huh, that's it, you know, and I'm not an alcoholic." But even back then, when I was 23 years old, now being 51, I knew, you know, and I quit when I was in my late 30s. 39 is when I finally, as you were saying, I finally got out of my own way, and I set the intention to really make that change. And I did that for myself. But, you know, I did that when I was 39. But I had been making those deals with myself, you know, all along.
Yeah, I think the key is that, like, it requires that spiritual awakening that we're here to talk about as well. You know, that like once we hit a bottom, that we realize that, I mean, at least for me, it was like, alcohol was my higher power. Like this, it's a mind altering substance. And when I was using it, it led my life. It had control over me. And something I laughed when you said about giving it up for Lent, because my sobriety date is in November. It was like after like a 5-day party run of Halloween that I finally had reached a level of incomprehensible demoralization.
Okay, so that, you had like a 5-day bender, binge, whatever,
yeah,
that kind of got you there.
So I had a high bottom, and like I went to like 5 different parties in 5 different costumes, like walking around in heels. Like on the outside, a lot of people were like, "What do you mean you're getting sober? Like, you don't have like a problem. You don't drink that much, you know?" And like I knew, though, that when I was at home, like I woke up on the couch and there was like a bowl of throw up under the couch. You know, I had like thrown up in a bowl and just kind of like tucked it under there. And like, I never talked to people about my ugly side of my drinking, or like if I was in blackouts all the time, mm-hmm. and I functioned so well that people would let me drive and I was walking fine. And like, thank God I didn't kill myself or someone else. Like, that is a yet on my, you know, how far down the scale I could go is I have still a lot of yets. And somebody told me that the bottom is just wherever you stop digging. And so if I start digging again, I will hit those other yets. And so I had like a plethora of parking tickets because I wouldn't know where I parked my car. Like, my life was unmanageable, especially on the inside. Like, I still got up and I went to work most of the time, unless I came up with some lie, you know, of why I couldn't come in that day. I still had an apartment. I still had a car. So I had a considerably high bottom. And what I will say, though, is when I was working in Malibu for years through my mid-20s, and I lived in one of the canyons, and I would drive through the canyon and think about driving off the cliff. Like, it would just be easier than facing like my life and my problems that seemed so horrendous that now looking back are just minuscule, you know, because like suicide is a permanent solution to temporary problems. Mm-hmm. And I would consider it, though. And I thought if I just did it that way, then it would be less of a blow on my family because like it would have been an accident. And like, it's mind boggling to remember how spiritually sick I was. And then I would drive home through the canyon like drunk and could have done it. And so I basically my drinking progressed kind of slowly through high school because I was the captain of the basketball team, and that kept me in line to a degree. And so I would party hard on the weekends and after the games and stuff. But I kept it together. And then I actually gave up a basketball scholarship to a D2 school because I wanted to be in Los Angeles. I grew up in the Bay Area. And so I went to Long Beach State, and they're D1, and I was supposed to try to walk on. And by the time I got there, and I was living in the dorms, my partying just like went off the rails like real quick, that I was like, well, there's no way that I'm going to manage a basketball career here and be able to party the way that I want to. And like you said, where you could go off for like a week or so, I was taught that I'm an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic, or what could make anybody an alcoholic, is to look at like, can you manage and enjoy your drinking? So I could manage it. I could go off for like a week, but were you like enjoying yourself, or like on the times when you were managing your drinks and like, I'm only going to have two tonight. And were you kind of like, okay, I'm ready to go. Are you guys ready to go? Like, let's call it a night. Whereas like, if you weren't managing it, then you would be there three more hours, you know, like, can you manage and enjoy when you're rigorously honest with yourself? And if the answer is no, then that's how I was able to, one of the ways I was able to know that I was an alcoholic.
So was there any one event that was a catalyst to finally setting that intention and being sincere and I'm going to get out of my way and this is it?
Well, I started to look back, and there was a lot of things that I gave up to drink. Like, so I gave up my basketball career. Like, I mean, I was female athlete of the year, all Bay Area, the year I graduated high school. And I could have really enjoyed, like, that's one thing I look back on and I'm like, wow, you know, like, I chose a party life over that opportunity. Yeah. And then I ended up joining a sorority after I moved out of the dorms because it's a commuter school and I just really wanted some more connection and community. And I had an opportunity to run for like a position in the house. And at one point, like, was offered like, hey, do you want to run for president and things like that? You had to live in the sorority house, though. And I was like, there's no way I'm not living in the sorority house because I won't be able to drink the way that I want to. And so I also smoked a ton of weed. And when weed became legal in California, I live in Texas now, and I just moved here this summer. And so I've been in California, northern or southern, my whole life. And when it became legal in California, I remember being like, you know, oh no, like, how is this going to affect my sobriety? Because I was already sober. And this old timer, like, sober guy that I knew, he was like, yeah, but alcohol has always been sober. I mean, always been legal. Alcohol has always been legal. And that was just like, you know what I mean? Like, Yeah. And I can't manage and enjoy that. And so weed was also like part of my sobriety journey to be able to give that up. And then I was bartending actually when I got sober. And the summer before I got sober, I found just like party drugs. And there's a lot of yets of drugs that I did not do. However, those ones accelerated my bottom to hit faster because, like you, I had horrific physical responses to it. Like I just would go for days and then just be like shaky and like in the fetal position and throwing up. And I, at my very bottom, I woke up, I was naked on a bare mattress with, in somebody else's apartment all by myself. So I was alone. And on one side was a pile of the bedding with my pee on it. And the other side was like a pile of throw up on their rug. Okay. And so it was ugly. I mean, it was out of control. So my life had become unmanageable. And the thing is that once I put one in, I don't know when I'm going to stop. And I can't guarantee what's going to happen. And I like hurt so many of my relationships and broke trust. And I really do believe that the person I became in drinking was like not who I want to be, right? Like not my most authentic self. And like some people do say that like a drunk man's words are a sober man's thoughts. And so like, yeah, if you've ever...
I think we all went through that phase where we say that, but is it really? I don't know.
Well, I just was like prude and selfish and like inconsiderate. And it just was like I became someone that I was out of alignment with my morals and my values and my integrity. And those were things that I needed to recover in my recovery.
So you got to that point and you made the decision to get sober. And what was there a mechanism you used? Did you walk into AA? Did you reach out to a friend? What did you use in your very early sobriety to help get you on the path and keep you there?
So I white knuckled willpower that first week because the friend whose house I was at and the look that I got that next morning was just like mortifying. And the report that I got was that I like pushed all the buttons and I was like yelling at people outside their apartment. And then I tried to pee in their plant. And then I was apparently rocking back and forth, pleading with God and saying, if you just take this pain away, I won't drink for 10 years. I won't drink for 10 years if you just take this pain away. Because drinking did get physically painful for me. Like I would get so sick to my stomach and it would. And so usually, though, that happened when I was alone or like I don't even remember it because I'm in a blackout because I didn't remember it from that night either. You know, this person had to tell me that they witnessed that. So for someone else to witness that, that was like, OK, that's enough for me not to drink today. It's enough for me to like maybe not drink for this week. And then I realized like, OK, you know, maybe I won't drink for 10 years. You know, maybe I'll keep my word to God. And I had grown up in a non-denominational unity church for a while, then the youth group when I was a kid. And my relationship with God was really just like unique in that I think my mom made space for me to develop a higher power of my own understanding. And it was never pushed on me. And maybe other people, I'm sure some people have that experience too. Other people have the experience where
London,
this is the
there?
Way it needs to be. And a part of my recovery journey has also been like, you know, like, well, does that work for me? And how can my God get bigger? And I realized like, if I was being told that I needed to align my will with my God's will for my life to be created with ease and flow and to like really tap into that intuition, I realized that my God was just love. And when I'm thinking something loving or doing something loving, then that's how I know that I'm in my God's will for my life. And so I was like, is it loving to drink, you know, like for my body? No. Is it loving to my friends and my family? No. So like, okay, it's just not working for me right now. So let me see how long I can go, maybe 10 years. So the reason why I was laughing earlier to circle back is like, then I use New Year's Eve, like you use Lent. I used my New Year's resolution that year. So I got sober in 2011 and November 2012, I was like, okay, I'm not going to drink for a year. And it was just what I told people publicly for acceptance because it was difficult. Like all the people I hung out with drank and mostly a lot of them drank a lot with me, you know? And so everyone was like, okay, sure. And then by April is when I got proposed or got the proposition to do Miss California, to do Miss Venice Beach. And I had actually yet to go into any rooms of 12-step programs. However, I had a friend who was going, and I had gotten familiar with this idea of the next right indicated action. Like, just follow the next right indicated action.
Right.
Which is like, you know, God's will for your life. Whatever God's will for your life is, just keep following the next right indicated action. And so at first I was like, you know, I'm an athlete. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, beauty pageant over here is like, was my initial reaction to it. And then somebody was like, yeah, but you just really embody like California. Like, you're from Northern California and you live down in Southern California. Like, I think you're an all California girl. So I was like, okay, I'll go for it. And talk about a God shot, like that I was in the right place doing the right thing with my life, being sober, like with the right people, is like the question was, who or what inspires you most? And like the other ladies, like one of them, it was like political, and I forget what the other one was, but I remember it, like, it's standing out to me that like, oh, that was a different question than what they got. And my sister was in the audience. And my sister had Down syndrome, and her and I were really, really close. And it was obviously her. And so I got to just pour out love to her. And I asked her to stand up in the theater. And I ended up winning. And it was so obvious that I was like totally naive and green at this whole pageant system thing, that when I got to Miss United States, I didn't even like place top 20. And then I ended up getting voted Miss Congeniality United States from the other states. And I give the testament of that to my sobriety again, because I was present and I wasn't checking out. And there was nothing that I was using to numb or to deal with my nerves and anxiety. And I was, because I was present, I was looking people in the eye and I was curious about their lives and asking them questions about themselves. And I was holding doors open, you know, like the things that I started to do and embody through being sober really changed the trajectory of my life.
Something really stands out to me right there. And you won that contest. You had your sister stand up. You were in that moment, very present. You were being utterly authentic, and you were just letting love lead the way. And what happened then? There was nothing fake. There was not. This is where, when we're present, when we let love lead the way, and we are just in the moment, that's when we allow the miracles to happen. And what happened? I don't like to always use the word manifested, or the pageant, you won the pageant, and it was just, you just were your authentic self in that moment.
Absolutely. And I think so often what I've learned over these last 13 years in my recovery journey is how people abandon that their authenticity. And usually it's for a connection, like to keep some connection in their life. They will abandon their authenticity. And for me, to keep the connection with alcohol, I was self-abandoning constantly. Yeah. And alcohol really is like I said earlier, it's your higher power at the time, but it's also like your best friend or my companion. And so when I got sober, I was breaking up. It was like the grief and the breakup of this relationship, because it is, you have a relationship with alcohol no matter how you drink, I think, you know, like you have a normie relationship if you can take a couple sips and leave the rest and walk on and not even think about it. Another thing, though, that somebody said, you know, you might be an alcoholic if, was that a normie never asks themselves or anyone else, do you think I'm an alcoholic? Like, a normie never questions, maybe I'm an alcoholic, or am I an alcoholic? Like, that if you're questioning if you're an alcoholic, like, I would invite you to dig deeper into that, you know, like, and where is that intuitive thought coming from? Because somebody like my mom's a total normie. She would drink like a half a glass of plum wine, and I would have had like three bottles of sake, and she'd be like, can you drive home? I'm a little tipsy.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, sure. Okay. No, but like, and then she wouldn't drink again for months and not even think about it or want it. So when somebody was like, oh, if you've ever questioned if you're an alcoholic, you might be one. I was like, okay. Because I was proud of being an alcoholic. And I mean, in college, once I reached college and I was drinking the way that I wanted to drink, blowing so much money, blowing basically my financial aid and like everything, you know, anyways, there, that song came out that was like, drink it if you really want it, ain't gotta put no extra on it. like, I'm a bleeping alcoholic. And I would just like blow that song up in my car, you know, and like I was proud to be drinking alcoholically for a time of my life, honestly. So I kind of knew that I was a real one.
Right.
For a while, it was just I never could conceive of a future without it. Like, I was sure I was going to be the grandma at 80 on my front porch, smoking a blunt, watching my grandkids like play in the yard. Like, the idea that I was not going to use mind altering substances to live this life was inconceivable until it became a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me ask you this then. You've gone through this process. You've decided you're going to get sober, though. You're in beauty pageants. You're embarking on your sober journey. When you first got sober, where were you spiritually? And kind of, can you describe that? And then what led to your spiritual awakening at that point? Or when did you start to spiritually awaken within your early sobriety? Or did you?
Yeah, I appreciate you taking me back to that moment. So I did end up joining a 12-step program. I actually dabbled in many 12-step programs, and they all brought value to my life. I'm still active in my primary program, and I did the steps, and I had a sponsor and sponsees, sure, and put myself in the middle of the pack and read the book and the other book. And so I started on that piece of my journey actually like closer to my 1 year, because one of my closest friends decided she was going to come into the rooms, and she was going to meetings all day long. She didn't have a car at the time. She had lost it from her drinking. She was riding her bike, and she didn't know what to do with herself before work, because we actually were bartending together. We both got sober bartending. Okay. And so that's possible too. And that was a gift in itself, because I would watch people come in totally just like themselves and then, you know, leave a different version of themselves. And that was helpful for me to see it right in front of my face. And so once I got into those rooms, I realized that like I had a sick spirit. Like that was the piece, because even though I was doing this Miss California stuff and that was keeping me sober, because I used it as part of my platform to, you know, sort of like a dare, you know, like keeping young youth off drugs and alcohol was part of my message. And so then I did that to help solidify that, okay, this is going to help me stay sober. You know, if I publicly put it out there like this, like sort of like I was like, my New Year's resolution, you know, like I needed accountability, honestly. And then the rooms offered me that too. And yet when I was still doing all that, I still felt like depressed on the inside, or like, what's like my purpose and what's my point? And like it gave me an opportunity to be of service by being Miss California. And still, it was like I couldn't get my relationships to work. Right. I still felt like I had trust issues. I still felt like I didn't know why I did what I did. There was a lot of confusion and disconnect still in those first couple years of sobriety. And somebody described it to me kind of like, if you've been eating junk food for like years and you just throw the trash, like you eat your like burger and then you throw the trash right there. You have your like drink and you throw the thing. And you're in like a station wagon and it's full of all the evidence and all the trash and all the stuff that you've been eating, but you're not looking back. You know, you're just like, nope, 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 nope. And then you get sober, it's kind of like slamming on the brakes. Like because I had to do full abstinence. Like it wasn't an option for me to just be like, okay, because like you said, I tried the other ways. Oh, I'll only drink when I'm out. Well, now I'm out all the time. Oh, I'll only drink if someone else buys it for me. And all of a sudden, like a bunch of people are like, here, have a drink, have a drink, have a drink, you know, or I'll only drink with people or at night because I love to day drink. And so I did the same thing with you, like that you did all the different like parameters and rules and all these different things to try to drink normally or to learn how to do it. And I couldn't. So when full abstinence came, it was like slamming on the brake of that station wagon. And it was like everything that I had been like ignoring and denying and stuffing just came like piling on me. Like if you can picture that, you know, like visual, just being in the front seat and like trying to drive your life and being covered in all of your trash, like all of your wreckage, you know? And so that's how I kind of really like describe my first couple years on the inside. Like on the outside, I still pretty much look like this. you know?
Yeah. So for me, it was a matter of I was physically sober. I was doing AA. I was working the steps, but I was still spiritually seeking. I was going back to Catholic church every weekend. It wasn't getting me there. For me, what started me on the truly spiritually, the real spiritual awakening, it's all part of the process, really. I mean, the emptiness, you've got to go through that to get to where you are now. But what really started the spiritual seeking and the spiritual maturity was one, I think I might have told you this, but I got a job 6 years ago with an employer that had a wellness program where we get a certain number of points over the course of the year if we participate and complete certain wellness activities. And one of them was I got like 400 points. You had to get to 3,000 or something, but 400 points if you downloaded a meditation app and you meditated for 10 minutes every day for a month. And I thought, wow, you know what? You know, I can just sit there and chill out and listen to somebody tell me to breathe and focus on whatever. And 10 minutes a day of meditation for 30 days, and it launched something. I started being into another world. I have never gone back. I'm like, this meditation stuff is great. And then everything started to snowball. Like, I started to get really curious about, you know, I'd always been fascinated with ESP and the other side and all these things growing up. Well, you know, ooh, I started listening to all this stuff while I'm driving around, like, you know, mediums and channeling and what's the other side like and all that stuff. So the meditation is really what peaked, what started the true spiritual journey that I've been on the last 6 years. So you were at a point where you're kind of empty inside. You're physically sober. Did you have anything like that that was a catalyst that might have started your spiritual, kind of your more heavy duty spiritual awakening?
Sure. Yes. So prayer and meditation is one of the steps, and that I had been dabbling in once I was doing the steps. And that was really impactful for me as well. And I ended up going to a women's retreat at the Glass House in Northern California, which is connected with Pivot, which I later became a Pivot certified relationship coach as a result of how much it worked for me in my life. So everything good in my life today is a result of my sobriety because it's all built on top of that. And I got sober and then I was like, okay, what else? Just like you, like what's next? Or, you know, and I didn't want to just be dry sober. I didn't want to just be going through the motions and like having a so-so life. It was like, if I'm going to do that, I might as well just like blot out my existence drinking. You know, I wanted to feel like I had purpose and fulfilled and full of joy. And there's this like saying like happy, joyous, and free. I wanted that, right? And so I realized, yeah, I was having a lot of trouble in my relationships, and I wanted to understand, make sense of it for myself, why I was attaching to things that way. And I went to this retreat. Now it's only 5 days. At the time that I went, it was 12 days. So it was really immersive. And while I was there, I did no caffeine, I don't smoke, and I ate really clean, and I exercised the whole time I was there. I meditated, I journaled, I read. I didn't have a cell phone handy, or like I wasn't using the internet, you know, and so I unplugged for 12 straight days and did a deep dive into how I think, how I feel, the actions that are connected to those things from my developmental psychology timeline of my life. And it like was this huge aha for me about how disconnected I had been to my authenticity, like you were saying, you know, like how I'm able to show up now. And I call God because it's easy for me to say that. And so I want to be really clear, like whatever somebody else's relationship with God is, it's unique to you. And it just like it's unique to me. That's the way that I live. And I can talk to God directly myself, like, is what I learned about myself. And I can hear a voice in my head that I can intuitively tell is like, is spirit coming in and guiding me differently than how my anxiety pushes, or my like my depression or fear pulls or weighs down, you know, like, and I used to describe it that like, my alcoholic voice, like my anxiety is like a chihuahua, like right. In my head, right? Like when your head is loud and it's like, how could you do that? What's wrong with you? Da-da-da-da, right? And then my my intuitive like voice is like kind of like the howl of a wolf. It's just like, it's there and it holds its like place and it like lets me know it's present and I can either listen or I can tune it out. And so I started, once I realized that I could tell the difference between my higher power's will for my life's guidance inside of my head and my loud self-will run riot kind of thoughts, I realized that I could adjust the volume on those. And I could recognize when the volume was loud on my chihuahua, and I started to be able to like, okay, so what's the opposite of that? You know, like, because if we're taught to take contrary action and we're taught to do different things to get different results. And I was like, okay, so if this is telling me to do this, what's the opposite? And that is high level stuff to even consider doing the opposite of the habitual do's that we're so used to, you know, like to really pivot and do a healthy do. And so for the first like few years, honestly, like I would hear the message, but when I listened to it, you know, And then it started to get really present and apparent where it would be like, I remember this one time my eye caught a safety pin and I was just like, okay, but like, why am I, my brain out of all the things I'm doing, trying to get out of the house, would I register and like zoom in on this safety pin on the counter? And I just like kind of dismissed it. And then later I was at a wedding and one of the dresses popped and we needed a safety pin. And I was like, oh my goodness, like that's wild to like be so connected and to recognize that I am so guided by spirit all the time.
All the time. And I tell people that you always have that voice going off in your head. You have to learn how to hear it. And then number two, the biggest thing is you have to learn to trust it. That's the, you know, following what the voice says is something different altogether. But I think with people when they are first newly sober and they are, as you were describing, empty inside and, you know, physically sober, spiritually seeking, then they have these experiences that kind of wake them up. But just prior to that, though, I think everybody wants to, and anybody who's listening to this and might not be there, what they want to do is they want to know how to hear that voice in their head and how to distinguish it and how to accept that it's not crazy. It's not me making things up. Because I think a lot of people are like, I just want to know what to do. I just want to know what to do when they're in early sobriety. And I think we have figured out how to do that after years of working on the spiritual practices and everything like that. But I think that's where a lot of people are at. So is there anything, you got into the meditation and you went on the retreat, and how did you start to really learn to, is there something that, you mentioned the chihuahua versus the other, was there something that, and you had some experiences that helped you kind of tune in and kind of like the safety pin kind of showed you like, hey, look, you're not crazy. What was the point when you started really, was there anything that helped you really learn to trust yourself? What was that point?
Sure. Yeah. I just absolutely love that we're having this conversation. I think it's so valuable that you're going to be presenting conversations like this out into the world.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think a lot of us, when we first turn to spirit, even, or we start going to pray, we want to know what to do because we're sober, but you know what? We still got the bills and we still have the broken relationships and everything like that. And it's like, oh, I just want somebody to tell me what to do, whether it's, you know, Angel Gabriel materializing on my couch, or it's the voice in my head, or it's, you know, my guru or whoever, you know, I mean, you know, when did you start to really, really be able to discern the difference? And how'd you do that?
Well, discernment is actually a really great word that you're bringing up too. Like learning how to have discernment is part of this healthy adult, like secure, sober muscle that I have grown within me to be able to discern, well, which part of me is activated in this situation? You know, like what would I normally do versus what is God's will for my life? And like, it always comes back to like, well, I know that God's will for my life is to be loving and to do something loving and to think something loving. So I actually started doing this thing called shop your thoughts, where I picture that, like, even if you had all the money in the world and you could just literally buy anything you wanted, like, it's likely you, if you go into a store, you still wouldn't buy every single size and every single color because they don't all fit you. They're not your style. You know, like, you wouldn't buy, even if you loved one blouse, you wouldn't buy it in every size. And so this idea that, like, we have to stop buying all of our thoughts. We have to stop thinking that everything that comes in our head is like something that we need to put on and create as part of our identity and walk around all day with. Like, just because I had the thought, like, you know, well, that you were so stupid for doing that. Like, just because I had that thought, like, that thought does not serve me today. That is not who I want to be or who I am becoming. Even if I thought that about myself in the past, the way to divorce my future from my past is in this moment right now. And if I'm going to continue to buy that thought or that belief and like put it on and wear it as like a garment throughout the day, you know what I mean? Like, imagine if you put on all those thoughts, what you would look like, right? So buying the thoughts that like are like, usually you don't need that many beliefs about yourself all day long to like really shine your authenticity. Usually it's pretty simple. Like, simple is our superpower often, right? Like, we complicate it. We make it. It's like, even with the 12-step program, it's a simple program for really complex people. So I shop my thoughts. And if I put on a thought, if a belief, if I like buy into it, basically, if I buy it, and then I walk out of the metaphorical store and I'm like going along that day and I realize, oh, this keeps snagging on things, right? Like, it doesn't really fit me. Like, it's not really what I want to be living like. Like, if the thought is like, oh man, I just like blew that podcast, right? Like, I wish I would have said all these other different things and blah, 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 blah. Like, if my head's starting to run down that path that like I made up this belief about myself, I'm making a judgment about myself that I don't really even need. And it doesn't even, you know, like, it's not going to serve me. That would be like getting a snag in this new like thought that I bought and put on. And, you know, I can just donate it. I can just give it back. I can just let it go. I can just send it back to spirit and be like, that is not for me today. And so I shop my thoughts. Sometimes if I'm like out and about and I like, and there's like a bunch of thoughts going, I picture them as like on a conveyor belt. Mm-hmm. And you know, like when you pick out, they pick out like the ones that are going to be good. And then like all the ones that have bruises in them or something, I'm thinking like a potato or an apple or something go on or vice versa. So I imagine that I'm just like taking the ones that work for me and I'm leaving the rest and I just let them go on. And just because it came in my head does not mean that I need to go to the next thought. And the way this relates to sobriety is like, I'm never going to be able, I don't think, no matter, I mean, we'll see, but however much I work at this, I don't think I can control that very first thought. I can influence the first thoughts based on like what I practice focusing on, because what you focus on grows. I can influence like where my thoughts go. However, like when I go to something and they're walking in with like a tray of champagne and it's free and it's like the beginning of the party and it looks glamorous and everybody is like fabulous and they're drinking, yeah. You know, my first thought is like, yeah, that looks nice. That looks good. I wonder if I would just have a glass of wine with my girlfriends at lunch, you know, like the first thought still comes, even though I'm super clear when I play that tape to the end, it is not for me. And it there's too much to risk. It costs me a life worth living that I have today that I've created on top of my sobriety. So I am clear that it's not for me. And that first thought still comes. Yeah. And so we can't, I don't know if anybody else out there can control the first thought, but I can't necessarily control the first thought. I do have power and choice though on what I do with that thought. And if I snowball it into more, if I go down that spiral or if I spiral up, right? Like if I focus on it being a trigger or if I can pivot in it to being a glimmer of like, you know, showing me how far I've come, that I can have the first thought and I can go a different direction. So that's like a tangible tool that somebody could use in early sobriety is like, play the tape through all the way to the end. Where does this really get you? I never let myself use the F it button. I don't push the F it button anymore. You know, like when people are like, I'm not sure. You know, they're trying to strengthen their discernment. And they're like, I'm not sure. Oh, well, F it. Let's just do it. F it. I do not push the F it button for anything anymore. I pause when agitated or doubtful, especially. I pause. I try to consider, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? What am I wanting to do to get into alignment with myself? If I can, if I'm in a place that's appropriate, I'll close my eyes. I will imagine the energy of source coming straight from the cosmos down through my crown chakra, going all the way through all my chakras, straight into the earth, which I believe you do too, because that's something I picked up in Earth Magic Academy.
There we go. Now we're talking.
I then allow it to like pull me like a tether between the two, mm-hmm. between the core of the earth and the core of the universe, straight through my being. And I then say a prayer, and I try to have my prayers centered on God, what would you have me do? God, what is your will for my life? Because if I'm telling God what I want to get done, you know, that's still right. my will.
So then when you ask God, higher power, source,
Spirit,
whatever anybody wants to call it, right?
Universe.
Yeah. You know, whatever you want to call it, when you ask, what would you have for my life? What comes back? How do you know that you're being talked back to?
Okay. Yeah. So one aha moment that I had was I was like late to get to work in LA, and I turned down this road and there was the trash truck and it was blocking. And I was like, because I was doing a different route to try to cut out some time. And I turned down and I was completely stopped. And I was like, oh, you know, and I literally was like, okay, God, what would you have me do? You know, like what, you know, okay, I surrender, right? Because to surrender, I was taught, was to join the winning team. And so if I surrender to God, I'm joining the winning team. I'm waving the white flag that my way doesn't work. I can't. God can. I'm going to let him. Like, I'm going to let it, you know, guide me. And so, and then in that moment, I remember it was like, you just need to relax. Like, you just need, you're going to get there when you get there. And like, it's okay. And just relax. Like, and I just was like, okay, you know, yeah, maybe I'm going to be 5 minutes late. And maybe I'm going to need to speak directly to that in a humble way and say, thank you for being patient, you know, and maybe I'm going to need to amend that behavior moving forward so that I can be more on time in the future. In this moment right now, I just need to relax, because I truly got the message that we achieve less with stress.
Mm-hmm.
Stress impedes our progress, that when we're stressing out, that's when we fumble things. That's when we forget things. That's when, right? And that to be in God's will for my life is to be in this ease and flow, that God's got my back. God's time is always better than mine. God's plan is always better than mine. So when I think it's not working, instead of just pounding on the door that's shut in my face, true faith for me is turning around and looking for the doors that are open, you know, saying like, okay, now what, God? And so I just pause and I sat there. I took some deep breaths. I use this thing where I do the deep breaths like this, you know, like that helps me to like actually do it, because I'll say, oh, I'm going to do 10 deep breaths and three in, I'm done, you know, like, but if I'm following my finger, then it keeps me accountable to finishing some deep breaths. And I sat there and I did that, and it all worked out, because somebody also said to me, like, if it's not okay, it's always okay in the end. So if it's not okay, it just means it's not the end yet, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the only way out is through. So using corny slogans was also a big part of this for me.
So you surrender a lot, you know, and you just pause and you get present. I know something you're also into, and you let everything, you know, you let the voice come in, you let, you know, God, universe, creator, source direct you or take care and resolve the situation. I know something you're into is signs. You like to see the signs and synchronicities. And for anybody listening, I'm going to give you one of my examples here. So just the other night, I woke up and I turn over and I look at the clock. And we've all, you know, 333444 when we see the number signs. Well, you know, sometimes I see these number signs, and when I see them in order, and it just clicks, I just think that is spirit telling me that, you know, you're progressing. I'm right here. You know, God, it's God. I've got your back, whatever. So I roll over and it's 1234, 1234. All right. You know, now to the skeptic out there, you can say, oh, well, that's just coincidence. And my brain wants to do that too. I doubt myself all the time on this spiritual journey. So I go back to sleep. And what do? I wake up at, what was it? It was 3:45. The next time I open my eyes, it says 3:45 on the clock. And I think back to back, boom, boom. Now you're talking about one hell of a coincidence. So that's when my trust takes over, and I have enough of these experiences. So it's like, yeah, there's something really happening here. And those instances are proof of it. How do you feel about that? What are some...
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
I see angel numbers like all the time. Literally,
right.
I will see, like the other day, I'm in the drive-through line trying to get our daughter some food before her gymnastics practice. And there was four parked cars in one drive-through U-turn that had angel numbers on them. And two of them were the same, 888. And I actually got really in tune to these after my sister passed. She passed in 2022. And right after she passed, I started seeing 222, like all the time. And I looked it up and it was like, you're okay. You know, you're doing the right thing. Like you're safe. Like just trust the process is kind of like just a like cliff notes of what I remember from that. Maybe people who are into numerology and things like that, like it's more specific. That's right. Just what stuck with me. And so I saw it like everywhere. I then on my birthday last year, I was out of town, actually at a pivot retreat for the coaches. And I decided to go get a massage. I wasn't feeling that great. And I decided to like go get a massage on my birthday to like get ready for the evening. And I got back in the car and the person had offered to pick me up because it was my birthday. And I went to go get in the car. And on the passenger side, there was this giant heart drawn on the ground, like right at the passenger door. And it didn't belong there otherwise. You know, it apparently didn't belong there. And so I had been like connecting with my sister during the massage. And I was like really feeling her. So I think maybe this was 2023. So it was like she had passed in 2022 and this was my next birthday. So it was my first birthday without her. And so then all of a sudden I was like, okay, like I think this is a gift for my sister. And now I start to see hearts in places they otherwise wouldn't be. And it actually just happened to me today.
Right.
I made a little video. I haven't shared it. And we've cleaned up most of the Christmas stuff. We still have our tree up and stuff, but we've cleaned up everything else. Under like sticking out from the couch where we decided to do a puzzle because we're having a snow day in Texas. So we were like indoors doing all kinds of stuff is one of the tag ribbons that holds the tag on, and it's tied at the bottom, and it looks like it had been cut or ripped or something, and it was in the shape of a heart. It was a red ribbon in the shape of a heart right there, like under my couch, when all the other like trash, you know, at this point it's trash, had been thrown away. And I was just like, oh my gosh, look, she's here right now. And so I call it my godtourage. Like my dad has passed. My dad passed suddenly on our honeymoon. My dad has passed in my sobriety. My sister has passed, and I've stayed sober no matter what. You know, because I know that drinking's right. Not going to bring them back. And if anything, that like they want me to live this life, and I'm living this life the way I am now in honor of them. And so my dad, too, you know, the timing of things, like trusting God's timing is like, I was so upset and in a really dark place after that happened. And like, how could this be? How is this your will for my life, God? Questioning that. And then I looked back and I realized about a year later that he died a week after my wedding and not a week before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever was going on with his health, it was going to happen. And even though I didn't know it was coming, it could have happened a week before. And my whole wedding would have been, you know, like ruined. I wouldn't have had my dad be able to walk me down the aisle. Like he was able to walk me down the aisle in the last time most people ever saw him was like one of the happiest times of his life. And you know, that's God's timing. And we actually moved our wedding up because my sister went into septic shock at our engagement dinner, and I thought she was going to die, and she was my maid of honor. So we moved our wedding up 3 months, as much as we could, you know, to move a whole wedding. We moved it up 3 months. And then if we hadn't done that because of my sister, we wouldn't have made it to the other date. My dad wouldn't have lived. And then we conceived my son, our son, on our anniversary date, which was supposed to be our original wedding date. And then he was 9 days late from his due date, and he ended up being born on our wedding date.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about like, you know, synchronicities and dates,
right.
And things. And had we not moved the wedding up, then there would have been no way he could have done that because it would have been a year in between. But because we moved it up 3 months, then we were only engaged for 9 months. And so then our son was literally inside of my body the exact amount of time between our engagement time and our wedding time on a different year, of course.
Yeah.
Like, but how those things line up. And to me, I go, is it odd or is it God? And every time I just believe it's God.
Yeah, it's all about your perspective. I'm going to give you another example right now as you started. I don't know if it did it on your end, but your video froze when you started talking about your dad for about 5 seconds.
Wow.
And I could look at that as, yeah, the dang internet glitched out around here or on your end. Or we could say, was that your dad saying hello?
Yeah. And that's I think, perspective.
You know, and you got to look at like the timing of these things, and you just got to flip the script a little bit on that. You
and
know,
that's actually a tangible tool you're offering, Tim, is like it is dis-ease. If alcoholism is a disease, dis-ease comes from our perception. It's a disease mm-hmm. of perception, how we perceive reality. And so to pivot it, to like really amend it and to do contrary perception is like then to create ease in our life. And so,
yeah.
Like, look, every job is going to have people that like piss you off or annoy you if you give them that power, if you're giving it away like that. Or you can own it, like I'm annoyed, not they're making me pissed, right? Like I'm pissed. And then even a step further, besides owning your own reality, is like just trusting, you know, in the process that like, yeah there's going to be people at every job, no matter what job I have, that are going to be like annoying and frustrating to deal with. And it doesn't mean that I like can't do this job or I shouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. It's like, how can I adjust how can I put on a new pair of glasses and adjust my viewpoint to the situation to create something that's a more loving thought and then allow space for God then to do his work? Because I think like some people think other people are lucky, you know, like, oh, you're lucky or like just have all these opportunities. And I think it's like you prepare to be able to receive from the universe. Mm-hmm. Some people call it being in God's favor, but like you prepare your life in a certain way so that when you meet opportunities, you're ready and you can actually see them available. Yeah. And I couldn't see them until I was sober.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. What are, for the person who is sober and they want to become more connected and start to have spiritual experiences where they feel that they are recognizing or they are starting to hear the voice in their head, what are some of your favorite practices that you do, like meditation, breath work, yoga, what, you know? What do you do regularly?
I wake up and I read a daily reflection. So I set my intention for the day based on like a one-page thing that talks about something related to sobriety and usually perspective or fear or higher power, you know, and then at the bottom, it gives you kind of like a one-liner. And I set my intention for the day. And I've also been practicing in the morning because I do use my phone as my alarm. And so I've been practicing counting backwards from 100 to 1 before even looking at my phone. Like I can turn the alarm off and then not check anything, you know, and just be there in my awakening for the day.
Mm-hmm.
I count backwards from 100 and then I get up and I go to the restroom and I like try to start my day without first going to like what's on my text messages, what's in my email, right? Like that I think is really important. I've also really started to limit television. Somebody told me that it's called television because it's telling you a vision.
And that makes sense.
How can we be like fully embodying our vision for our life or God's vision for our life when mm-hmm. we're just sitting in front of something that's telling us their vision?
Yeah.
And that's really sparked my creativity because I think it's important, especially like in early sobriety, it's important to honor that like boredom is part of the process initially. Like it's okay and it's actually good to be bored because it's a springboard. That's how I think of being bored. I think of being bored as a springboard into creativity. Because if I checked out of the boredom by like just turning on the TV or just scrolling or something, you know, then I've lost my creativity. If I sit with the boredom, I sit with the discomfort, I try to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, then all of a sudden it's like, well, how about do this? And that's my intuitive thought, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Something I do when I get bored now, instead of turning on the TV or something, I'll start to meditate, even if it's for 5 minutes. And you will be surprised. You probably aren't surprised, but people listening or watching this would maybe be surprised at how much comes in when you really start to. And it takes time. Meditation takes practice. A lot of people get frustrated. And, you know, there's a lot of good ways to ease into it, whether you start with guided meditation or breath work or whatever. But, you know, that's something that that I've done to kind of help fill up the boredom there instead of turning to the television or something like that.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right to mention, you know, that people get frustrated and stuff. And I think it's because at least for me, I had this idea of how meditation had to be. Like I had to have like an altar, or I had to have like a special place to sit, or I needed to light a candle or whatnot. For me, I do it all the time, anywhere, like you, prayer and meditation. So I meditate like when I'm washing my hair in the shower.
Mm-hmm.
I picture setting that grounding cord, and then I just try to like check out of my thoughts and just go like, okay, God, what would you have me know right now? Like, what is the next right indicated action that you would have me take? And then I just try to just be quiet in my mind. And so you can do active meditation. Like you don't even just have to sit still. And then I drop like prayer bombs. Like if somebody cuts me off on the road, instead of thinking like, you know, like how we're like, I guess, conditioned to be about like taking it personal, I pause and my new perspective of ease and flow is like, wow, that person really must need to get somewhere, you know, like mm-hmm. I hope they get there safely. And then I'll imagine a giant like golden ball of love and light and stuff. And I will shoot it out from my car, from my heart over to their car. And I'll imagine it explodes all over them in a prayer of like, please, God, help them get to wherever they need to go and help mm-hmm. them find peace and help them, you know, like, so I do things like that all day long.
Oh, yeah. And I am a big believer, and I think you are too. If you put that prayer, that big ball of love and peace, and you send it out to them, that comes back to you. The universe pays you back. And whether it might not be directly back from them, but love and peace will circle around and come back to you in one way or another. What you put out, you do receive. That's something that I've found. But I don't want to digress too much here. So let me ask you this. Where do you think your life is now? How do you feel about who London Reber is right now that you have, you know, followed and looked into all these spiritual avenues and you've kind of found out what works for you? Where are you at now versus when you were newly sober and you weren't as spiritually connected?
Yeah, I truly do have like really big faith that when something looks like a challenge, or it feels painful, or it looks disappointing, like that's the outfit it's wearing, you know, like that's what it looks like on the outside, I always, almost always, like sometimes maybe not that moment, but pretty much that day, I'm able to look underneath that and be like, what is the gift here?
Mm-hmm.
Because I was taught that pain is the cornerstone of growth, and that there's always growth happening when I'm in pain, like going to the gym and getting sore, you know, you're building muscle and it's going to mm-hmm. be sore the next day, or it's painful when you're literally doing it. And so I imagine that I like have this spiritual fitness and this spiritual gym. And the more that I show up consistently over a long period of time, the more that I have done that, because I think you'll be successful at anything you show up consistently over a long period of time at, even like talking bad about yourself and then having low self-esteem, right? Like mm-hmm. anything you do consistently over a long period of time, you will become successful at it. And mm-hmm. so by doing that, by practicing spiritual tools and like knowing the difference between spirituality and religion, I actually practice spiritual tools religiously, right? Like to me, that's what the basis of a religion is like doing it consistently over a long period of time. And so the more I have journaled and gone to God in my tough times and continued to seek what's the gift in this, right? Like what, how, and seeing that like when people really get me, like when I get activated still by someone, which isn't very often, you know, before it was all the time, it's her fault and it's their fault. And you point the finger at someone and three are pointed back at you is what somebody told me. And so the more I've looked at like all the ways that I'm producing this in my life, the more I've able to take responsibility for my life and the more empowered I've become as a result of that, that like nothing's happening to me, it's happening for me. If I have that perspective, then what's come out of it for me is like anytime someone is like, oh, like doing something that really is like I'm like feeling frustrated about, I'm able to be like, okay, thank you for the gift of shining light on where I still have growth to do, mm-hmm. on where I still have healing. Thank you for this opportunity of showing me where I can still let go of more and turn more over and grow my faith bigger. And so today, like we bought a house and moved here this summer, and like we had another house that we were in contract with before this one, and we were trying to make it work. It had quite a few elements that were on our dream house list, and we are trying to force the other elements that really were going to be difficult to make it happen. And we kept finding out things and finding out things that just kept showing us this is not your house. And it was really hard because we were already in contract and it's like, oh my God, can we pull out now? And we'd already given our earnest money and stuff, you know? And it's so often, and I use that, the line of like, what's the price of my sanity? And mm-hmm. I used to self-abandon all the time. And then I was insane because I was, you know, costing myself my sanity every time I self-abandoned. And what's the price of my sanity? Well, like, yeah, it's $33,000 or whatever, $25,000 it's going to cost us. And like that, you know? And this is not our house. And so I had to speak up and I had to say to my husband, like, my intuition is telling me so loud and clear. I know we wanted it to be our house and we were excited about it and we're trying to force it, but it feels like our will. And I'm getting told loud and clear that this is not our house. And right. Thank goodness I have aligned my life with a partner that respects that and values that and supports that and was willing to follow my lead on that. And then we started looking again, and the house that like we have now wasn't even on the market then and had come on the market in the meantime. And we did get like our dream house. And as a result, that other house sued us. It was like, okay, I guess the reason why I'm saying is because like that's a big life moment where it's like I start to question, well, like, was it? Did I make the right decision? I start to doubt, like you said, the word doubt. And I've gotten this practice where when doubt knocks, I open the door and I knock that doubt out. Like is how I picture my teenage part of self is like, oh no, you're not welcome here anymore. I serve the eviction notice, you know, or like I call the cops and have them escorted off my property. Doubt is not welcome in my right. life anymore. So as soon as doubt starts to come in, because it's a form of fear and it's like fear or love, pick one, you know, and if mm-hmm. I'm living a life that's love driven, then fear does not have space in this. And when I'm in fear, I can't be in faith.
Yeah.
And so when that doubt started to come, I was like, no, you know, this is just the price of my sanity. And this is a lesson learned that we didn't read that fine print close enough with DocuSign skipping over everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this is an opportunity for growth that we're going to be doing business with people. We need to really check things on a like more different. I was able to take responsibility for something that other people would really just complain of, I think, yeah. or at least I would, maybe not other people, but myself. Myself in early sobriety would have bitched and moaned and like to yeah. anybody who would have listened to me about it, and I would have been the victim.
So you got sued. You ate that, and yeah. you chose to look at it as a lesson. Sure. What you said is you took responsibility. Your ability, you took command of your ability to respond instead of getting ticked off.
I dropped this mic.
What? Yeah, you. I heard that. That's not a Tim original. I heard that one the other day, but it went wow. ding, 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 ding.
Thank you for owned bringing it to me.
Your ability to respond. That's going to happen. Whatever. It's going to happen. How are you going to look at it? Mm-hmm. Is this a learning opportunity? Is this a catalyst for growth? Or is it something I'm just going to stew on and be bitter about?
Yeah.
And you're choosing to go the other way.
Yeah,
and I think in the long run, there are going to be reasons that things turned out the way they did and why you are where you are. And, you know, we everything happens for a reason. And you sound amazingly at peace and grounded in what you've decided.
Yeah, I was doing a reflection on like somebody, I was doing a guided meditation.
Yeah.
Somebody was inviting us to look at like the worst thing of the year because it was like to let it go and cut cords yeah. and stuff. And I had a hard time thinking about what was the worst thing of the year. Like, there were some things that happened like that, that were like pretty profoundly right. like frustrating and disappointing. And to be able to like actually be challenged in recalling them because of the kind of peace that I create as I'm going. So that's another thing is I don't allow a bunch to like pile up under the rug because yeah. I'm really big on metaphors and my mind has, I like have photographic memory. So I picture it like every time you don't walk towards a difficult conversation or deal with something in real time, when they say brush it under the rug, sweep it under the rug. I picture that the mound under the rug just keeps being bigger and bigger and bigger, like this big hill under the rug. And now I'm trying to walk through the room and you're tripping on it or you have to avoid it every time to get around it. I don't have any mounds in my rug anymore. That is a result of my sobriety and my spiritual awakening.
And your spirituality. So, you know, I'm going to get ready to kind of wrap up here. But what I want to know is, you know, we talked about your, you know, what got you sober and then your journey into deeper spirituality, your perspective on a lot of things. You know, where I think sober awakening is going to meet a lot of people is that empty space of I'm sober and what do I do? And now I know there are people who are going to be watching this and they're going to be like, oh my God, that London Reber, I want to be just like her. I want the peace. I want to be able to say, oh my God, I'm sued for $30,000. I'm still cool. Instead of going off the deep end and running back out to the drink, you know, they're going to be able to flip the script. I want to know how to be able to listen to that intuitive voice in my head. I want to be able to know how to see the signs and interpret them like London does. I see London and I want to have what she has. Where do they start? What's a practical place to start down that spiritual path? If you had to pick a starting point, what would it be?
I have to say, like, your language and communication, like how mm-hmm. you communicate with yourself, like monitoring, like you're being really hyper aware of your thoughts. And starting to develop new neural pathways, like putting red flags in those neural pathways that take you down a dark path that doesn't have to be your story anymore. It's a part of who you were. And also you can change your, in that moment, you can reframe and redirect your thinking. Like the thinking and things that we say to ourselves and to other people matter so much because that is the perspective. You know, the first year that I was sober, I decided I was not going to say not. And I actually sounded like a crazy person because I would be like, oh, I'm not going to go out tonight. I mean, I'm going to stay in tonight because I had this like aha moment from spirit that like not is the opposite of what is. And so if I'm talking about what's not, I'm talking about the non-existent because what is, you know, and that's right. What exists. And so I'm talking about the non-existent. So that's not even like fully truthful. Like I got really deep on this thing.
I think if nothing else, somebody who is looking to be more like London or have London's perspective, have her amazing, awesome life. And just because you just shine, you're like just so bright and full of love and light. And you know, if they could just try to practice, I think I'm going to try that for as much as I can do so this week, not to say not. Instead of, like you just said, I'm not going out tonight. No, I'm just going to stay in tonight and just avoid that. I mean, I think that, you know, these little tips and tricks and kind of these little tools, they can help people take those first steps.
Yeah, it created more authenticity for me. I was telling the truth. And still use discernment, you know, don't overshare, don't tell everything to somebody who's not a safe person with that information, right?
Right.
Like, be mindful of who you're speaking to and what you're speaking about when you're talking. And if you can speak about what is, that to me, it made a huge difference in my ability to see things differently.
Yes. And I think that's what a lot of people who are going to be drawn to sober awakening are looking for. So I think London, we're gonna wrap up with that one.
Yeah, I would love for people to come check me out on my socials too.
Yes, where can they find London Reber? Because you do have a lot of great stuff. You're on Instagram, TikTok, all that stuff. I'll let you tell people where to find you, but you have a lot of stuff that is very inspirational and there are a lot of good daily tips and tricks of just perspective and things like that. So
thank you, Tim. Yeah, that too was like I was doing this coaching for years and I hadn't shared it publicly really. And then when I did the Supermom contest, I started dripping some things in and the feedback was like, can we get more of this? And so that was like started out of service, like to be of service. And so my handle is at @heyitslondon_. I spell London just like the city. And my Instagram has quite a decent community now. And I'm so grateful to everyone who is following me and participating in this journey with me and commenting and communicating, you know, like, because I do see people's comments and then I'll make more videos about it. So if they're or DM me, I respond to my own DMs, you know, like send me a message about something that you're struggling with or something that you want more insight with. And I would be happy to share what I would do in that situation or, you know, some spiritual guidance that I could offer.
Excellent. Well, London, I have thoroughly enjoyed this very first conversation on the books for Sober Awakening. And is there anything you want to throw out there before we conclude here? that
you know,
we didn't.
What intuitively just came to me was when I said spiritual guidance was like, that was a huge piece for me on this journey is finding people who have what I want and then seeing what they do and then doing what they do to get what they have and to put myself in the position to absorb information and knowledge and energy from people who are just a little bit ahead of me on whatever journey you're looking to be on, instead of just staying around. Because they say that thing where like whoever the five people are that you interact with the most in your life, you're going to become like them, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you're recognizing that you're around people that are, you feel heavy or you feel like your light is dimmed, you know, it's up to you to take the responsibility, to really use your agency to have the ability to respond to that situation by using healthier boundaries, because boundaries have nothing to do with how much we love someone. We could absolutely love our, you know, your mom. And then every time you call her, though, you feel like you're second guessing yourself.
Right.
There needs to be a boundary there, right? So put yourself around or follow accounts that uplift your life and offer you that kind of like new attitude and outlook and perspective, because it really does matter, because everything that you're ingesting, like TV and music and everything that you consume is just like if you imagine eating, right? Like if you eat junk food, your body's going to be dirty on the inside and it's going to be sluggish and is all the things, right? Like if you consume that kind of music, if you consume like murder shows, you know, or whatnot,
right.
Like it's affecting you. So just being like really aware of like what you're allowing into your life and why you're allowing that person, place, or thing to have so much access, unless it's inspiring you to be your best self and to show up authentically.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, London.
Thank you, Tim.
Love you here. I love that you are a part of Sober Awakening, and I am just so excited to see what we can build together with this thing. And you have been a blessing to me, my life. I have just adored getting to know you, and the best is just yet to come. So anyway, yeah, I guess that is it. We'll conclude the first one, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for putting this out into the world and offering this to people and to really recognizing that, you know, that crossroads between that sober awakening, I mean, that spiritual awakening and that sobriety, to connect those dots, Tim, is brilliant. And I thank you so much for creating this nonprofit. And I know you're going to really make a huge impact.
Well, I tell you what, like I said, when we first started, you're going to come back 1 year from now and we're going to get, whether I'm doing this with you like this or we are co-hosting or something like that with somebody else or whatever. And we are going to revisit where we were right now and compared to where we're going to be in a year. And I think we are going to be amazed. So
I have
anyway,
no doubts. I fully
All right.
I have faith.
All right.
You can work, you know?
London, thank you for everything.
Thank you.
That's it.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Sober Awakening Podcast. We are so grateful and excited that you're part of this journey. As always, please remember, any businesses, services, or individuals mentioned here are shared because they resonate with our mission. We receive no financial benefit from promoting them. It's all about guiding you toward what inspires and empowers your journey. If you've found value in this podcast, please consider supporting our mission with a tax-deductible donation at www.soberawakening.org. Every contribution helps us continue providing resources and inspiration for those seeking sobriety and spiritual fulfillment. Don't forget to subscribe, share this episode, and visit us at soberawakening.org for more resources and upcoming events. Let's continue this path together toward a life of sobriety and spiritual fulfillment. We love you so much. Until next time, stay sober-minded and intuitively guided.